First, Dr. Martin Luther King's confrontations with overt racism in the Deep South are a big part of the story we tell today. But our next guest says there's a lot more to the story. King also fought against racial inequality here in the Midwest and elsewhere, and he was critical of the white northern moderates and liberals who backed his efforts in the South, but not in their hometowns. Jean Theo Harris reminds us of this history in a recent piece for The Washington Post. She's a distinguished professor of political science at Brooklyn College of the City University of New York. She's also author of the book A More Beautiful and Terrible History, The Uses and Misuses of Civil Rights History. Jean, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Dr. King, you say, talked about polite racism from white liberals during the Civil Rights Movement. Can you talk about what he meant by that?
So one of the things, if we look at Dr. King, and this is really across his, again, shortened adult life, but really from the beginning of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference founding, which was in 1957, we hear Dr. King both calling and working against the kind of racial inequality of the South, but at the same time also talking to and being critical of and challenging to Northern liberals. So from 57 on, he's saying we need a liberalism that's liberal, not just in calling out sort of lynching in Mississippi, but that is equally outraged when someone can't get a job or can't get housing, you know, in their own cities, right? So he was calling out one of the things he's calling out is the tendency to see the problems elsewhere and not to attend to the problems at home, be it in New York or Milwaukee or L.A. And also in this period, he is, even though they're building this movement in the South, he's also crisscrossing the North, joining with struggles across the Northeast and Midwest and West Coast, again, from Detroit to Boston to L.A. In this period. And I think we know much less about that.
Yeah, I came across a Martin Luther King quote after he was assaulted in Chicago in 1966. He was in the midst of housing discrimination protests there. He said, "I've been in many demonstrations all across the South, but I can say that I have never seen, even in Mississippi and Alabama, mobs as hostile and as hate-filled as I'm seeing in Chicago." So just one example in the Midwest there. Why are we blinded to that part of the story outside of the Deep South these days?
So I think part of the ways that we now tell the story of the Civil Rights Movement, and I often talk about this as a kind of fable of the Civil Rights Movement, is I think by telling a story that's in the South, right, that focuses on a Southern struggle from sort of 1954 onward, that is kind of driven by people like Dr. King, galvanized after Rosa Parks' bus stand, and a growing movement across the South that wins the support of Northern white liberals and journalists and ultimately the federal government. And then we have the 1964 Civil Rights Act and the 1965 Voting Rights Act. And I think that story is powerful, but it's limited, and I think it's easy because it's a story then that makes it seem like there's struggle, but then there's a largely happy ending. I think when you begin to include Chicago or Milwaukee or Boston or New York, where I live, you have to tell a harder story because you have movements in all those cities, right, from the 50s and the 60s, calling out school segregation, calling out housing segregation, calling out police brutality, calling out job discrimination. And by and large, a lot of those movements are ignored, they're disparaged, and many of those problems, right, are with us today because we didn't take those movements seriously, and we didn't sort of really hunker down to do what we needed to do in terms of really addressing, again, school inequality, housing segregation, inequitable city services, policing, unequal policing. And so these are issues that people are calling out, not just in Birmingham, right? But again, I think it's easier to kind of see the problem in Birmingham because then then in some sense it's a problem and then we've solved it, right? And so I think part of the way we often now honor the civil rights movement, honor Dr. King, honor Rosa Parks is in part by putting the movement in the past. And to really grapple with the Northern struggle, I think, forces us just to really also see what needs to be done in the present.
Talking to Jean Theo Harris from Brooklyn College of the City University of New York. She's talking about some unlearned lessons from the civil rights movement are often unlearned even to this day. Mm-hmm. Jean, let's talk about the response that King and other civil rights leaders got when they protested in places like New York or Chicago or Milwaukee from the white liberals and moderates who might have considered themselves otherwise allies of the movement.
Right, right. So as you mentioned, with the campaign in 1966 in Chicago, King gets a lot of backlash, not just that violent backlash that you just quoted him from, but also from white liberals, white allies, who said these direct action tactics, they were holding marches, right? They were doing open housing marches. You know, in some ways, a lot like what Father Grappi and people did in Milwaukee in this period as well, right? And this is, for many white liberals in Chicago, this kind of disruptive direct action made them uncomfortable. And so even though when it had been happening in Birmingham, many of those people might have been supportive, when it comes home, you're not doing it right. So I think that's part of the reaction. Another part of the reaction is this sort of talking about the ways to solve kind of inequality in northern cities, focusing on black behavior, black crime. And we see King also taking those kinds of language and those kinds of ways of framing the problem to task. So King will say, and I'm paraphrasing him, but basically when we ask sort of black people to follow the law, we also have to ask white people to follow the law. We have to ask them to sort of abide by sort of equal employment hiring, by kind of landlords to abide by kind of laws governing, right, tenements, welfare laws, police to abide, you know. And so he's saying we have to look at the kind of larger structures of inequity in these cities. And yet many times white liberals in those cities were saying, well, the solutions are going to be in changing sort of black behavior, changing the black community. And Dr. King is saying, no, we have to look at changing policy.
And you mentioned a direct action and sometimes disruptive protests. You've also talked more recently about modern day critics of things like the Black Lives Matter movement saying, well, you're doing things that Dr. King never would have done.
Right. And and I think there's the historian in me that's just like, as you may remember, you know, we've had a lot of people, you know, telling Black Lives Matter activists, be more like Martin Luther King. And in my head, I think to myself, be careful what you wish for. And really, I think people really miss the similarities in terms of the tactics, in terms of the larger kind of structural critiques that people like Dr. King is making, that people like Rosa Parks are making, to what kind of Black Lives Matter activists are making today, including that disruption and direct action were necessary, right? That part of kind of how injustice maintains itself is by the kind of comfortableness that many people have with it. And so part of why, and again, if we think of the kind of perhaps one of the most iconic moments of the civil rights movement being the Montgomery bus boycott, what is that, right? It is a disruptive consumer boycott. It is meant to bring the bus company and the city to its knees. Right. But again, I think now when we look back on the Montgomery bus boycott, we've sanitized it. We've missed what the power of it was. Right. But we've also missed how uncomfortable it was, because it was sort of disrupting business as usual. Right. So I think part of what King is saying kind of over and again is, when he's criticized for these tactics, he's saying we are bringing this kind of tension, this inequality to the surface. It is there. We are not causing this, right? We are, you know, we are bringing this to the surface so it can be dealt with, right? But I think for many people, that kind of direct action or disruption is uncomfortable precisely because it brings that injustice sort of to the surface.
We're talking to professor and author Jean Theo Harris about Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and how popular histories can fail to include his criticism of so-called polite racism by white liberals and his activities in the Northeast and Midwest as well. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Were you aware of this part of King's history? Are you just hearing about it for the first time? Did you already know this? Do you have questions for our guest about our civil rights history and the myth and reality? You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We pick up our conversation with Professor Jean Theo Harris from Brooklyn College at the City University of New York, talking about Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., his critiques back during the civil rights movement of white moderates and liberals, especially in the North, who supported his civil rights efforts in the South, but not in their own hometowns. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions for our guest, your thoughts, and maybe your memories of that time. Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll go to your calls now. Paul is with us in Madison. Paul, hi.
This is Marcus.
I'm sorry, Marcus in Madison. Hi.
Hi. Thank you, Professor Harris. I'd like you to enlarge on this point. There is a lot of mythology about the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. while he was alive. He was fiercely opposed by the Kennedy administration and the Kennedy liberals generally. They tried to hamstring him in every possible way they could, until the civil rights movement became a large enough factor that they sort of had to go along. But later on, when Dr. King started to point out his criticisms of the Vietnam War, militarism in general, capitalism, and was planning the Poor People's Campaign, he was actively opposed by the Democrats and the liberal left. I was wondering if you could speak on that, please.
Marcus, thanks for the call. Jean?
Thanks for the question. Yeah, I mean, I think it's important to remember that Dr. King and that the civil rights movement, even as we sort of how we imagine it today, we imagine that most decent, good people supported the civil rights movement when it was happening, supported Dr. King. But that's not true. When you look at Gallup surveys from the early 60s, for instance, a majority of Americans are critical of the tactics. In the week before the March on Washington, a majority of Americans, again, surveyed by Gallup, have an unfavorable, are not supportive of the March on Washington. Like you mentioned, right, the Kennedy administration tries to prevent the March on Washington when they can't. They're still very wary of it. And in fact, it is after the March on Washington that the FBI's surveillance of King expands and Robert Kennedy signs off on the kind of, wall-to-wall surveillance of Dr. King that fall. So it is after the March on Washington that we see that surveillance expanded. Again, I think we often, on this day, we often are just treated to like endless replays of the end of the March on Washington speech. And I would ask people to go and look at the whole speech, because in fact, where King begins the March on Washington speech is about how America has given black people a bad check. And they have come to Washington because they know that the bank is not empty, right? But they have come to collect, right? This is a very different King than the kind of constantly dreaming King that we are often kind of bombarded with. As you mentioned, increasingly over the later 60s, we see King talking about the giant triplets of poverty, racism, and militarism, right? He comes out against the war in Vietnam. He is building a Poor People's Campaign, a multiracial Poor People's Campaign at the end of his life, which Coretta Scott King and poor people across the country continue even after his assassination. So I think we backdate our admiration for him in some ways because, again, I think it is comfortable to think that, you know, good people sort of are on the right side of history. And I think one of the things that really looking at Dr. King's life and really looking at the civil rights movement reminds us is how hard they fought, how long they fought, what it took to kind of to pull people to sort of seeing and being willing to act on kind of beginning to undo some of this sort of systematic sort of segregation and racial inequality. And again, we have a lot more to go.
Thanks a lot for that call. We're talking to Jean Theo Harris from Brooklyn College at the City University of New York, looking back on Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and a lot of the myth versus reality of his part in the civil rights movement. Back to your calls now. Carlene is with us in Brooklyn, the Wisconsin Brooklyn. Carlene, hi.
Mm-hmm. Hi. Thank you so much for your comments, Professor Harris. I just wanted to put a plug in for a class that is being taught, I believe, this year for the fifth time at the Fountain of Life Church in Madison. It's coordinated by Dr. Reverend G, who's pastor of that church. You might remember him from years back writing the Justified Anger article that appeared in the Isthmus here in Madison when he was pulled over in the parking lot of his church by police as a black man there, seeming questionable. Anyway, the class is Black History for a New Day. It starts next Monday, the 27th of January, from 7 to 9, and it features professors from the UW and panelists in over the 10 weeks to talk about exactly some of the things that you are talking about with a focus on Wisconsin, but beginning with how slavery didn't just benefit the South, benefited the whole economy of the colonies and bringing us right up to 2020. So I'd highly recommend it.
Hey, Carlene, I'm going to jump in. I want to get Jean in on this. This is one example here in Wisconsin. Do you see a movement, Jean, toward people trying to kind of return and come to grips with the realities of the civil rights movement?
Yeah, I certainly do. And I think people are very hungry. I mean, I think we are in the moment. We are in a moment of like hunger about, you know, thinking about, you know, thinking seriously about how we build movements today and therefore thinking seriously about the history, really wanting to learn the history of these movements. One book I can recommend for people interested in the civil rights movement in Milwaukee is Patrick Jones' Selma of the North. Just to sort of, I mean, I think partly we have to know this history. And I think regrettably, even as a sort of material on the Southern civil rights movement makes it into, you know, elementary school, high school, college, not always as much on the civil rights movement outside the South, but there are now a number of resources to draw on in terms of if you want to learn more on that as well.
Thanks for the call, Carlene. We'll go now to Lori with us in Vernon County. Lori, hello.
Oh, hello. Thank you. I'm interested in the letter in the Birmingham jail. That was also written to the black pastors in Birmingham as well, too. And I wonder if your professor would speak about the professional classes among the African Americans and how they interacted with Dr. King's movement. I'm also very interested in Chicago in the late 60s. It was interesting to me during the last election how John Lewis was not able to recall Bernie Sanders on the bridge, but Bernie Sanders had been being arrested in Chicago, facing down the Chicago police in the late 60s.
Mm-hmm. Lori, thanks for the call. Just a couple minutes left, Jean, for you to take that where you want to go.
Right. I think two points, right? I mean, I think partly why at first we couldn't recognize where Bernie Sanders was exactly this point, which is if we imagine and talk about the Southern civil rights movement as the civil rights movement, right, then it misses sort of all the things that people are doing in places outside of the South, including what's happening in Chicago, including what Bernie Sanders did. So I think that's the first thing. I think the second thing, in terms of the letter from a Birmingham jail, and he's writing as well to white clergy who had criticized him, is he is calling out, right, the white moderate in that in that letter and saying that in some ways the white moderate is more dangerous to the struggle for freedom than the Ku Klux Klanner. In part, he's saying because people are more devoted to order than to justice. And in that letter, he also talks about the myth of time and this idea that Americans in particular sort of hold to, which is that things are getting better and it might be slow, but we're just constantly getting better. And Dr. King says, no, time is neutral, right? You have to use time in a positive way. Things aren't just going to get better, you know, ever slowly and surely, right? So, I mean, I think going back to the letter, really listening to what Dr. King says, I think gives us a lot for kind of where we are today.
Thanks for that call, Lori. In our last few moments, Jean, your point is toward more resources, more things we can check out to revisit the history of the civil rights movement across the country.
We are now very lucky in that there are all sorts of books about the civil rights movement outside the South. So you can look for Matthew Countryman's book on Philadelphia. You can look for Brian Purnell's book on Brooklyn. You can look for Nishani Fraser's book on Cleveland. You can look for, I've edited a number of collections of kind of new work on the Black freedom struggle. The most recent one is called The Strange Careers of the Jim Crow North. It has a whole bunch of essays from sort of new scholars looking at the Black freedom struggle outside the South. Tom Segrew has a book that kind of synthesizes sort of the Northern struggle. Kamosi Woodard works on Newark. Right now we are beginning to have kind of a really robust sort of literature on the civil rights movement outside the South. And so I think it's incumbent on us as citizens, as teachers, right? Those of us who are teachers or professors, right? That now that material sort of we can bring into our classes, we can bring into our discussions, but for many of us, we're going to have to sort of learn new stuff.
Jean, that's a good place to leave it. Thanks so much for joining us today. That was Jean Theo Harris, Distinguished Professor of Political Science at Brooklyn College of the City University of New York. Her books include A More Beautiful and Terrible History, The Uses and Misuses of Civil Rights History. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network.